Recorded Books is pleased to present the Modern Scholar Series, where great professors teach you. My name is Richard Davidson, and I'll be your host. Today, we begin a course entitled, A House Reunited, How America Survived the Civil War. Your professor is Jay Winnick, a senior scholar of history and public policy in the School of Public Affairs at the University of Maryland. Professor Winnick received his bachelor's degree from Yale College. He earned his master's degree with distinction from the London School of Economics. His Ph.D. is from Yale University. In the public sector, Professor Winnick has had a distinguished career in national security, including advising the late Defense Secretary Les Aspin, and helping to create the landmark United Nations plan for ending the Cambodian Civil War. He's a popular public speaker and a frequent TV and radio guest. He contributes regularly to the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and appears frequently on the History Channel, NPR, Fox, C-SPAN, and NBC. His award-winning book, April 1865, The Month That Saved America, was a New York Times bestseller and the basis for a critically acclaimed and Emmy-nominated two-hour documentary special by A&E History Channel in 2003. It serves as the text for this course. In the final moments of the Civil War, the fate of our nation hung precariously in the balance, perhaps more so than at any other time since the Revolution. It was only through the resolve of strong individuals, the courage of great leaders, and the fortunes of circumstance that the United States managed to survive as one nation. While most Civil War courses focus on the entire sweep of the conflict, this course explores only the waning days of the great struggle. We'll closely examine the dramatic events leading up to April 1865, and ponder some of the unthinkable alternatives that, had they materialized, would have surely prevented the formation of the country we know today. In the end, we'll discover how our nation was saved at this most perilous time, not only by a devoted president, a stalwart general, and dedicated troops, but also by the grace and character of those who led the vanquished. For more information on this course, please visit its webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll have access to links to related sites, a seminar room to share your thoughts with other students, and yes, of course, a final exam. And now we begin A House Reunited, How America Survived the Civil War, Lecture 1, A Nation Delayed. And now, Professor Winnick.
It was a most precarious moment. Atlanta had been overwhelmed. Columbia surrendered and burned. Charleston abandoned. The peace conference at Hampton Roads had been fruitless, and the British and French had now refused to intervene. The Army of Northern Virginia, the Southern Army, having struck its own harsh blows against the Union in the six bloodiest weeks of the war, during the seesawing battles of the Wilderness Campaign in Central Virginia in 1864, they had now wriggled free of the enemy's clutches and fallen back, assuming a defensive position around the cities of Petersburg and Richmond. And across the slim divide of trenches and water lay U.S. Grant's mighty Army of the Potomac, the Northern Army. This was the Confederacy's direst crisis since the start of the war. It was vaster than the fall of Vicksburg. It was more terrible than the failure of Gettysburg. But now, a strange emotion prevailed throughout much of the Confederacy. It was, Southerners knew, not the first time in history that defenders had been cut to pieces, that they had been starved or demoralized or they had been enervated, and yet had somehow found the will to prevail. They still had four armies in the field, the Southerners knew, and man for man, some of the finest fighting men in all of history. They knew their guerrilla fighters and cavalry were second to none. And they knew their lineage was impeccable, stretching back to the Jamestown colonialists of 1607 to the founding fathers, including George Washington himself. This rekindled and strengthened their resolve. And so did their prayers, and so did their spirit. And now, confronted by the prospect of losing all, the Southerners hoped to find another leader, another George Washington, a figure who could rescue the South. After all the suffering and death, the multitude of exhaustion and despair, such a man, they hoped, such men, would be the Confederacy's last chance. And in the trenches, they believed, there was such a man. And across the Confederacy, they believed there were such men. A weary Abraham Lincoln also shared this thought, but to him it was a fear. Even now in this long, bloody conflict, Robert E. Lee, the Southern general, and the generals who looked to him for guidance, and many of his men, were as aggressive as ever. They were not ready to give up, they were not ready to give in, and they were not ready to relinquish their Confederate identity. This war was not over, not by a long shot, and the implications for the peace to follow were profound. It is the eve of April 1865. Even today, what followed in the remaining days of the Civil War seem almost miraculous, which we will discuss. April 1865 is a month that could have unraveled the American nation. Instead, it saved it. It is a month as dramatic and devastating as any faced in this nation's history, and it proved to be the most moving and decisive month, not simply of the Civil War, but quite likely in the life of the United States. Never before or since, as we will see, in the life of the nation, has the country been so tested, or have so many remarkable events happened with such breathtaking simultaneity and far-reaching consequences, and we will discuss them all in our series of lectures. They include surrender and assassination, the threat of guerrilla war and the dissolution of the American constitutional government, to name just a few examples. But consider a few of the other more unforgettable images that we will go over in our next 13 lectures, in addition to this one. This 1 month witnessed the frenzied, unforgettable retreat of Robert E. Lee's army. It witnessed the unforgettable images of Abraham Lincoln as he walked through a still smoldering Richmond as it burned. It witnessed the poignant, powerful, terrible bloodshed of Sailor's Creek, one of the most savage battles of the entirety of the war. It witnessed the fateful decision over whether or not guerrilla war would course through America. It witnessed the grandeur and dignity and magnanimity of the Appomattox surrender, one of the most poignant scenes in all of this nation's history. And 5 days later, it witnessed the possible decapitation of the Union government and the prospect of more terrible, more ruinous war. And we will discuss all this in our series of 14 lectures. Some of the most unforgettable images in this nation's history. And even as the war climaxed to a close, we will also look at what remained the most significant question of all, the question that consumed Abraham Lincoln, the question that haunted him, the question that kept him awake at night. And that was not simply how to subjugate the Confederacy by force of arms, but more importantly, how to reunite two separate political and military entities that had been bitter enemies just days before. Abraham Lincoln said this to his cabinet. He said, "There is no greater task before us, or for that matter before any future cabinet." In truth, this was the foremost challenge of the road to April 1865, and we will discuss it in our series of lectures. So this accomplishment, two warring nations becoming one, is perhaps one of the momentous achievements of all time, which we will examine in depth in our lectures. It is a story not simply of the war's denouement, but of the making of our nation. Indeed, ever since the founding of the Republic experiment in 1776, the U.S. was still very much a fragile entity, and each American generation was fearful of its prospect for survival. They knew that far too many civil wars had ended badly, with haunting results of more bloodshed, more strife, more civil war. And they knew that most republics throughout history had succumbed to revolution, or they had succumbed to dictatorship, or to more civil war, something that we have seen in our own day. Think about this. Witness the Irish question, for example, that has lingered for some 200 years. Or witness the ongoing bloodshed in Bosnia, or Cambodia with its killing fields, or Rwanda with its genocidal violence, or even the Middle East today, plagued by violence year after year after year, with melancholy regularity. While history was littered with bad endings, and our Civil War could have ended just as badly, with the same fateful consequences, but didn't. Why? How did this happen? How did we escape the cruel chain of history that has consigned so many countries to ongoing bloodshed and turmoil and death and destruction? Well, this is the story of the road to April 1865, which we will be looking at. And to understand this story is to grasp something quite precious. It is to see our country anew, and we will do that. And to understand the task of our first lecture, we must start at the beginning. And by the beginning, I don't mean April 1865, or by the beginning, I don't even mean the beginning of the Civil War, but we have to go all the way back to the very beginning of our country. Our view of the road to April 1865 will, we will see in the end, encompass not merely one fateful month in the life of this nation, but in many ways the totality of the American experience from its very founding. Now, back to the beginning. It is noteworthy that when the Founding Fathers got together to form this country of ours, nowhere in the writing of the Constitution did they talk about America being a nation, because they couldn't agree that America was a nation. It is equally noteworthy that nowhere in the Constitution did they talk about America lasting in perpetuity, because they couldn't agree that they would last in perpetuity. This, of course, was a great question that haunted the Founders. Would America last? Could it last? Well, for it to last, they all had to repudiate all of human history until that time. In no way should we take this to mean that we shouldn't applaud the Founders' achievements as one of the most daring undertakings in all of human history. With pluck, iron will, imagination, and unsurpassed brilliance, the Founders begot a national idea unlike any since the beginning of time. But all the boldness and brilliance of their achievements, a republic with a separation of powers and an independent judiciary, an accountable and representative government, but for all that, fateful questions still lingered and haunted the Founders. Consider the obstacles. To wit, the fragility of the American government from its very first days cannot be exaggerated. Unlike the rest of the world, America was not born out of ancient custom or claim, arising naturally as a nation, as a result of tens of centuries, the product of generations of common kinship, generations of common custom, generations of common language and myths and shared history and tradition. America was born artificially. It was born abstractly, as a series of states woven together by negotiated agreements. Unlike a Europe, or China, or Persia, it did not arise naturally, but it was made almost abstractly out of ink and paper, and lawyers and diplomats at the Constitutional Convention. When the first Declaration of Independence was introduced into Congress in 1776, Richard Henry Lee, seconded by John Adams, who of course would become one of our great presidents, declared that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. As one historian has noted, independence created not one nation, but 13. Think about that. It's a subtle but terribly important point. And now consider this also for a moment. Like the colonies that preceded them, these new states were as different from each other as they were from England itself. Each state jealously guarded its own self-rule. Each state jealously guarded its own government. Each state had its own independence, which it guarded carefully, its own sovereignty, which it guarded carefully. Each had its own navy, or commanded its own military. Each had its own legislatures, or president, or governor, its own court and taxes, and its own individual constitutions. And too often forgotten is this telling but stark fact. Before independence, Americans were British subjects, but they were also subjects of their home colonies, Virginia, for example, or Massachusetts, or New York. Yet after independence, they were no longer Britons, but they were not yet Americans. That would not happen for another 14 years. Again, it's a terribly crucial point for us to think in mind. So they remained faithful members of their proud states, as they had for more than 150 years in some cases, a fact we too often forget. Now think about this too for a second. 150 years. That time is roughly equal to the Civil War to this very time and space right now. And so for this very reason, America was essentially made out of 13 radically separate states, or actually, if you think about it, 13 separate countries. And to the extent that there was an American national identity, it was unexpected, it was impromptu, and it was an artificial creation of the Revolution, and in most cases, it was secondary. So for this reason, when the Constitutional Convention was finished, and later George Washington said it was a little short of a miracle that delegates from so many states should have united to form a separate national government. But still, George Washington had his doubts. He actually thought the country might only last for 20 years. And let's look at what another of our great founding fathers, Ben Franklin, had to say. He, too, was also ecstatic and elated by the results of the Constitutional Convention. Afterwards, a woman came up to him and said, "Well, what happened? What did you all do in there for 4 months in private?" And Franklin looked to this woman and he said, "We have created a republic, if we can keep it." So, the founding fathers created a national government, to be sure, but it was not yet quite a nation. In the annals of history, the founders had done something quite unique. As one historian has put it, John Murren of Princeton, he said, quote, "Americans erected their constitutional roof before they put up their national walls. In other words, we had a country before we had a nation." And in the ensuing years, there would be a price for such genius. The price of blood in the making of nations. We will learn more about this as well. And the founding fathers knew this themselves. For America to be successful, they all knew they had to repudiate the French philosopher Montesquieu. And Montesquieu is always referred to as the great Montesquieu. And what Montesquieu said was that the republic could not last except in a small landmass. And yet already the 13 states themselves were considered way too large. And for that matter, a number of the individual states themselves were considered way too large. Geography was also against the young Americans. As Americans trekked further south and west, the wilderness and the rivers and the mountains created breathtaking differences in lifestyles, in culture, and political outlook. For example, let's look at one instance of this. Pittsburgh was considered the far west, and the people of Pittsburgh were as different from the people of, say, New Haven, or Rhode Island, or Boston. They were as different from them as they were the people of France, or of England, or the Dutch. And what also did not change was the secessionist tradition of America, indeed a tradition that was older than the Revolution, indeed older than America itself, as old as the first colonial settlements. This, too, is a very important point for us to bear in mind in our course of lectures and today. From the very beginning, the discovery of the New World was made possible by repeated secessionist efforts. Think about how America was really founded on secession. The Pilgrims, of course, were the first great secessionists, coming to Plymouth after their failure to extrude themselves from England to the Netherlands. And so began our early history. Roger Williams, a separatist fanatic, well, he was driven from Massachusetts and went on to found Rhode Island. Thomas Hooker, another example, well, he seceded to Connecticut. And Lord Baltimore, well, he enabled a group of Catholics to create an exclusive community for a time in Maryland. And William Penn, well, he provided Quakers with a refuge. And, of course, the American Revolution was itself a monumental act of secession. And if you think about it, the revolutionaries in the Revolutionary War were not terribly dissimilar from the Southerners in the Civil War. They wanted self-determination and independence. Nor did independence change this pattern. Indeed, as if from the very start, and this is very important for us to remember, as if to prove Montesquieu's dire predictions right, America after the Revolution perpetually seemed to be on the brink of splitting apart. And it began with the Whiskey Rebellion. And no history of the young American Republic can be discussed without discussing the Whiskey Rebellion. Long before the country threatened to rip apart in the American Civil War, there was the first assault threatening to cleave the nation. And it threatened to cleave it not north-south, but east-west, with the Whiskey Rebellion. Fired up by the French revolutionaries, an army of 7,000 strong refused to pay taxes. They established revolutionary committees based on their revolutionary predecessors, and they issued calls for independence. And they would have to be put down by military force, in which the forces would be led by none other than Light Horse Harry Lee of Virginia, the father of Robert E. Lee, and in which the forces were reviewed by none other than George Washington himself. This was the first and only time a president has ever taken command, however briefly, of U.S. forces. The imposing show of force worked. The Whiskey Rebels were scattered. But if anything, the threat of secession hardly receded. Now let's look at another example of the early precariousness and the early fragility and the tenuousness of this young American republic. This time the next shot fired was fired on paper, with the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. What were these resolutions? These two resolutions asserted the right of individual states to nullify the acts of the federal government. And of course, in doing so, they would constitute a direct threat not only to the Constitution, they would constitute a direct threat not only to the 10-year-old United States, but of course they would later lay the philosophical basis for the American Civil War to come. Now, who authored these two resolutions? Well, none other than two of our greatest founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison themselves. Now let's look at another example of the early fragility and early precariousness of this young American republic. The next crisis would happen in just 13 years, and this time it was war. It was the War of 1812. And this time, the country is threatened to be rent asunder, not east-west, not north-south, but regionally. During the War of 1812, it was New England that was openly threatening secession. It was New England that was openly collaborating with our adversaries in the conflict, the British. And in one of the fascinating historical turns of the wheel, this was much to the consternation and to the disgust of none other than Southerners themselves. You know, I've gone back and read those debates, and they're just transfixing. And if you ever get a chance, you should do that as well. And then this pattern of secession and conflict and crisis continued. Between 1830 and 1833, the pendulum of secession continued, but this time it swung again, this time at long last to the South. And now it was South Carolina that was demanding regional self-interest and self-rights by trying to nullify federal tariff duties. The crisis was averted momentarily by President Andrew Jackson and Senator Henry Clay, and for a brief time it appeared that Southerners and Northerners might come together to forge one nation. But with each passing year, the prize that many founders had sought, union, again seemed increasingly elusive, as fierce debate began to rage over slavery, and a secessionist cry rose and spread. But this is not to say there weren't factors pushing hard in the other direction. The young America had doubled its population every two decades, leaving it behind only Russia and France in size. With almost a religious zeal, Americans were everywhere over the immensity of the continent's spaces. They were civilizing and democratizing. They were settling and republicanizing. And across the landscape, they were putting up balloon frame houses. They were putting up hand-hewn log wagons. They were putting up oxen and Conestoga wagons. They were putting up the horse and the buggy. And the country was developing an incipient national art. It was developing a rancorous national press. And it was even developing national idioms. The middle class was exploding. After a brief 60 years plus of history, many Americans were filled with astonishing optimism and a glowing sense of destiny. But this struggle to forge a national identity stood in stark contrast to direct separate nationalisms across the great American expanse, which refused to go away. In the years running up to the Civil War, slavery was then the wedge tearing the country apart. But as crucial as slavery was, it was hardly the only wedge. Even the way Americans spoke of the young republic betrayed concerns about the country lasting. To be sure, Americans spoke as union. But just as often as not, they spoke of the republic. Just as often as not, they spoke of America as a confederacy. Just as often as not, they spoke of the states united. And just as often as not, they spoke of a league of sovereign states. Even Thomas Jefferson, one of our greatest of presidents, for years he referred to Virginia as my country, and for many Americans this hadn't changed. In the parlance of the day, it was not the United States is, but the United States are. And state legislatures, to give you just another example of this, they actually saw Congress as a foreign body, and they even took it as their right to instruct U.S. senators how to vote. In fact, in the years running up to the Civil War, let's look at who else flirted with secession, who considered secession, who talked about secession. Well, California talked secession, and so did Oregon, and so did New Jersey. And for that matter, literally on the eve of the Civil War, under Mayor Hernando Wood, in the weeks and actually days leading up to the war, so did New York City. In New York City's case, their one dilemma is whether or not to strike out on their own or to join in some kind of league of confederacy with the emerging confederacy that was now taking place. So what this shows is that many Americans thought, just as many Americans believed, and just as many Americans feared, that the United States would inevitably and invariably break up into three or four separate confederacies to boot. Now, four long years later, With America the endpoint of this terrible civil war in 1865, there were bitter and haunting questions that remained. It was not simply a matter of would the North, or for that matter the South, win the war, but the very large issue of how the war would end and the peace would be made. And if there's one point I want to stress in this lecture, it is this. History shows us that how wars end is every bit as crucial as why they start and how they are fought. So what we want to think about in this lecture and in the upcoming lectures are these central points. Would America, would the country emerge united, one nation, Abraham Lincoln's fervent dream? Or would it remain tattered, ever ready to disintegrate into petty, squabbling, minor or fragmented republics, and become chronically vulnerable to anarchy or low-level violence, as had been the dismal fate of so many other republics throughout history, or for that matter in our own time? These were the great questions on the road to April 1865, and as April 1865 approached. We will answer them over the course of our remaining lectures. But what ultimately drove the country to war was slavery. The institution was as old as the colonies. The first enslaved Americans had arrived in Virginia, in fact, as early as 1619. And in fact, slavery flourished throughout the country, north as well as south, until 1790. But in 1790, a rather dramatic event took place in the history of this young republic. Ben Franklin, one of our greatest of founding fathers, who at that point was dying. He was 81 years old. His body was racked by gout and terrible pain. In fact, such terrible pain that he was actually on laudanum, which was a form of opium. Well, Ben Franklin, all his life, had been a great compromiser, compromising on all the great issues from as early as 1753. Yet suddenly, at the age of 81, dying in terrible pain, he decided on one issue, not to compromise. And this is fascinating. He decided, along with the Pennsylvania Quakers, to issue a petition to the Congress to call for the eradication and the abolition of slavery. And what would take place would be some 2 days of fierce and heated debate in the Congress to discuss whether or not to abolish and to eradicate slavery. And in many ways, this debate that took place would presage and foreshadow the later debates that would take place and that would haunt the Congress for decades leading up to the American Civil War. And in one very poignant moment, one of the South Carolina delegates was talking about slaves as though they were nothing more than property, like cattle or sheep. And at that point, Ben Franklin ripped back and he said, "Yes, but sheep do not make revolutions." Nonetheless, for all the moral causes and all the moral cases that Ben Franklin and the Quakers made in 1790, this measure failed. And it failed because at that early stage, it threatened to rip the country apart in its infancy, to strangle it in its crib. To be sure, perhaps there was no choice, but it was a fateful moral decision. Nonetheless, what we see with slavery is that in time, beginning with Massachusetts and ending with New Jersey, the northern states, one by one by one, abolished bondage. And it was hoped that the southern states would eventually do likewise. And that was actually what was discussed in the 2-day debate in Congress. But as it turned out, slavery stubbornly persisted. In fact, in 1794, there would be an invention called the cotton gin, which would actually give rise to plantations throughout the lower South, which depended on slave labor. And as it turned out, the cotton gin would deepen and intensify the dependence in the South upon slavery. And so what we see happened in the South is that slavery would eventually become so intertwined and so intermixed with the fabric of Southern life that even though only 1/3 of Southerners themselves owned slaves, in every way, shape, and form, slavery seemed to become an integral part of the Southern experience and the Southern life. And so at that point, what we would see is that any assault on slavery from the North would be regarded as an assault on Southern values. It would be regarded as an assault on the very Southern way of life, and it would be regarded as an assault, for that matter, on the South itself. In the 19th century, the ferment over slavery only grew. What we see is that in the North, slavery soon became a deep matter of great conscience, and it was spurred on by religious fervor of the Second Great Awakening. Year after year, with evangelic fervor, we see that anti-slavery advocates kept scratching away with their pens, and they kept opening their mouths and it kept calling for freedom for people of all colors. And what we see is that year after year, Southern politicians and Southern leaders bitterly fought back. They wanted to keep slavery. And in the vortex of this debate, once the battle lines were sharply drawn, moderate ground became hostage to the passion of the two sides. By 1860, what we see is that slavery had been banned by all the European colonizers, and it had been eradicated in virtually all of Latin America, and it was widely condemned, for that matter, by the Roman Catholic Church. Slavery thrived only in Brazil. It thrived only in Cuba. And, of course, it thrived only in the American South and its border states. But that was enough. Slavery, in the end, would be the precipitant cause that would plunge America into civil war, and, of course, would be made much worse by the fact that America, having its tradition of regionalism and secessionism, was much more precarious and much more vulnerable to this terrible question.
This ends Lecture 1.